Let's say you arrive at the doors of this police academy. Like when you're trying to pursue this career path, and well, everybody has different reasons for going into the police, and like there's the cliches of old, and it's true. A lot of them are true, where you have guys there who never won a fair fight in their life, or have never experienced any sort of authority or power, and they're looking for that. You know, there's some of that in some of these places. And there's some people that want to make a difference because they grew up on G.I. Joe and somehow they believed all the propaganda, I guess. Why are you there?
When I was younger, I would say like because first it was kind of like, oh, the public service aspect was always just kind of there. I always liked it. And I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew that I wanted to help people.
Yeah, like that. You said you... paramedic and
yeah, I got my EMT, and then I was looking at nursing and a bunch of other stuff, and I went on a ride along because it's weird, unless you really are immersed in that world, you only know a fraction of a percent of what it entails. And my takeaways from my experiences were just, oh, they drive around and write tickets. I don't really know, but want to go closer, sorry.
Yeah, that's fine.
But one of the things that I really wanted to do, and this was kind of going back to my dad, was he didn't care what we did for a living as long as we did it well, and we gave more than we took. And so that was something that I was raised with. And if you live with that mentality, you'll be a better person. And if you're a better person, you'll have a more fulfilled life. And I didn't really register that till I was well into my 20s, where I was like, maybe I should do something. And the cop thing came about.
How old are you when you decide to go into this cop route?
When I started applying, I was 23. And 23. This is during the recession. So there wasn't a lot cooking in terms of jobs. And there's two ways you go through an academy. You go through sponsored, where you get paid to be there, and
yeah, you get you get some money every
yeah. And then there's a non-paid affiliate where you pay for yourself. And
it's
crazy
for my mind. Like, I'm from Mexico, none of that shit happens.
No,
so it's like here when I went through it, my mind was you would go in and you would get like an allowance every end of month if it arrived, you know. So you would be fucking shit out of luck, basically trying to make ends meet. So there you have to pay for it yourself, or you get some sort of like government money.
Yeah, you'll basically be employed. So you'll be an employee pending graduation and all that stuff. And I had gotten accepted twice, I think, before they weren't doing any paid spots. This is for Sac County Sheriff's Department. And ultimately I just said like, fuck it. I just got to do it. And we were a class of 62, and out of the entire class, there were four that were sponsored affiliates from other agencies, not Sacramento. And so that was kind of a real eye-opener for the economy, and everyone was a little freaked out about getting jobs. Nobody was really hiring. And so I was 24 when I got in. It's a six-month academy, and then after the 6 months, you're out. And the academy was fun. It was, you know, it was hard, but it was fun. I made a lot of good friends and still keep in touch with a few of them. But we graduated 33, had 66, graduated 33. And in California, most places you get essentially your driver's license called a post certificate. You have to activate that within 3 years for it to stay valid. So I ended up taking a job as a reserve for a very small police department and worked there, got my post activated, which was great. And ended up kind of getting sucked into a full-time position there. It wasn't a good agency. It was actually a really bad, corrupt agency. And
when you say corruption, what do you mean? Like what?
Before my time. So the city itself was in financial ruin. The cops previously, there was a lot of guns and dope and just stuff that went missing and got sold. And just your standard run-of-the-mill corruption.
I mean, it's an edge. So you'll see economies going down in the toilet, standards being lowered, shit just sliding.
Yeah, it was a horrible place to be. But I was just so happy to have a job and to be doing the job. And most of my friends from the academy were still trying really hard to find a place to work. Yeah, them, so, yeah. So that was cool. Hindsight 2020, I learned a lot about internal politics and city leadership. And it's very different working for a city versus a county. The county, even though it is more political, it's an elected official. The police department carries an appointed position. So yeah. It's a lot of bullshit. And I went through three chiefs in almost 3 years, and two of which got fired. And then ultimately the police department disbanded and the sheriff's department took over for $80,000 a year. And then, so I had to go find a new job. I did. And I've been with my current agency ever since. And I will say it's personal preference, but working for a sheriff's department, the community aspect and the support aspect is so different. When
why do you think that is?
I think because the he's literally chosen by the people. So he's, a sheriff
he's
is
he's an elected, elected he's, yeah. he's an elected official, which is yep. another weird aspect for people that might be listening from other parts of the world.
Depends
that
on where you live.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like,
very much
for,
so.
Like for me, like I've met a few sheriffs, mm-hmm. and it's always just mind blowing to me the power they wield because it's the sheriff, right? Mm-hmm. They'll show up and the political side of their position, the fact that he's publicly elected is kind of like unique in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the aspect of working for a department like that, working at a sheriff's, the difference. Community wise and like longevity wise, is there more done to keep people on, I guess?
That's a interesting topic to bring up right now. Retention. Wow. I mean, yeah, it's, it depends on where you are.
Yeah. So, I know people are moving because, we just went through, is it safe to say 2-3 years of council of the police or four?
I would say now four. I would say like 2-3 and then almost 4, like at first 2 years. Yeah, it was bad.
For me, outside perspective again, I've been through a few police academies in the United States, some in Texas. I see empty classrooms. I see standards lowered. I see a lot of short people.
Mm-hmm.
I see a youth that doesn't want to even touch anything related to the police. And I see a pretty successful anti-cop campaign across the country being played out for about 2-3 years, 4 years. It's not something that a lot of kids want to grow up to be now because of the way that they are now kind of painted, you know, as a villain. So you arrive at this new department, different. You kind of describe a little bit about, you know, it being where you needed to be. Like what does that job entail? Is it community policing?
Yeah. So with my agency, there's not a lot of just avenues to go down. I would put us at like a medium sized agency, in terms of looking at some of the larger cities, you have all these other assignments and collateral stuff. So for me, it was patrol. I worked Graves for a long time with a really good team. I really liked working Graves with my team. It was
what is Graves mean?
Graveyard is grave. So night shift.
Night shift. And this is from what hour to what hour?
We were 6 to 6. So 6 p.m. to 6 a.m.
6 p.m. to 6 a.m. Oh, that's way better than we were 8 to 8. That sucked for some reason. I don't know.
P.m. or a.m.?
Eight p.m. to 8 a.m.
That's a weird shift.
Yeah, it was. And also, it would never be 8 a.m. It would be usually 10 or 11 because we would have to
hold over.
It's a bunch of bullshit. But I did that for like a year and a half straight. It was fun. First year, you know, you get graveyard as a
automatic. Oh, yeah. You're going to get weekend graveyard. That's automatic.
What are you learning at that time in light about humanity?
Interestingly enough, my whole life, I've always been someone who could talk to anybody, and I always do talk to anybody. It drives my wife nuts, but I'm a people person, and I can talk to people. And I learned really quickly the really neat people that I would meet on patrol were just some of the like wildest people you could ever imagine, and you wouldn't see them in a normal scenario. So I really enjoyed the aspect of being in a weird place with weird people.
At a weird time.
At a very weird time. And talking to them, you know, like it was always fun. And the team that I worked with, we all were very like-minded. So we were very proactive, but we also were pretty chill. Like you don't need to be an asshole unless it's time to be an asshole. And we would most of the time just kind of shoot the shit with a lot of these guys if we didn't have to arrest them for something. And the relationships you can build with those people, and I really stress this for the new guys, is that the small things you do when you're new or newer, or even now if you're starting back and doing something different, just developing relationships like with the bad guys in the community is huge. And depending on where you work, I promise you that one day you're going to need them in some way, and they may need you in some way. And working your beat, immersing yourself in that beat, and just really getting to know your players is huge. And you'll benefit so much just from learning the other side. Like you use the phrase upside down a lot. And I actually like that a lot myself, to where you just sort of go to this different side of the world that the normal, you know, quote unquote normal,
it flips.
They just don't see it. And when you're awake at 3 o'clock in the morning dealing with this very strange, odd incident, and these people who otherwise wouldn't be there are now the nexus of this incident, it's just one of those things where you kind of have to appreciate the oddities that you'll run into.
Yeah.
Strange people.
For me, it was about, and I learned this from one of the older guys. He said, if you show up and somebody is there with an alternative lifestyle and with a very different worldview than you have, act fascinated about it, ask a lot of questions around it, be curious about it, be friendly, and not be judgmental. And it will provide you a key into a varied amount of worlds. And it's true.
Absolutely true.
I remember walking into a nightclub here in Tijuana. It's nearby here in Zona Norte, where a lot of rainbow flags, you know? No judgment on my end. I'm just, you know, fascinated about everything, like complimenting people on their wardrobes and stuff like that, and their handcuffs. Like, oh, these are pretty cool. They're not real, right? No, they're fine. But just the changing the attitude from being an authority figure arriving into being a capable person with boundaries, like legit curious about stuff and treating people. Not respect is too strong of a word, because some of these people respect gets earned after a while. Mm-hmm. But just treating people as human beings, they're just different. That's a different dimension than all these people are living in. I travel across the country now, and every now and then I get to places where things are beyond the normal of my mind. You know, like, hey, this person is worth, you know, a few million. Like he spends $1 million a month, you know, on. Because that's his net worth aspect of it. And I generally just act curious about it. And mm-hmm. just like, I'm new to everything. It's a pretty good way of going about life, or else you already have a bunch of enemies out there in the middle of the night just because of the badge you wear.
Yeah.
So it's probably a good idea to make a few converts out of them.
It is. And that's all on how it's basic interaction. Just be human, be nice. And even if you take someone into custody, like it's one of those things where, you know, and the guys I worked with, we were notorious for having these guys go, hey, thanks for being cool. Like once the dust has settled, then we were in booking and they're done being upset. They just would say, hey, thanks.
And a lot of it is just for the other guys there.
Sure.
Right.
Because I got to show off in front of my friends or
like, yeah, fuck the place. Yeah. Yeah. Fuck you. Yeah. Are. And then it was always amazing to be seeing them shift when they were.
Oh yeah. Handcuff hero.
Yeah.
It's weird though, because I think about, you mentioned like the newer generation. There's so much of a weird disconnect with that, where talking is not, it doesn't come stock anymore.
I think it's technological autism.
Yes.
I mean, it's calling somebody just out of the blue straight on their phone.
That's a weird thing to do now.
It's like,
depending on your age.
Yeah. Like I'll do it every now and then. I'll just like, fuck it. I'm just going to call this specific person randomly. And they're like, okay.
Is everything okay?
Like, yeah. Like, are you good? Is everything good, Ed? Like, yeah, it's fine. I just wanted to call you. Just fucking surprise you. It's like, what's going on? Okay. Just social aspects and physical social aspects and cues.
They can't talk to people.
Like, it's...
And it's not their fault.
No, it's just the environment they're growing up
in. I feel like you and I both, age-wise, when we first got our smartphone, we were well into adulthood, and it was just different. But now, it's the small things, you know, just asking a girl on a date is done through text versus our generation. You had to walk up and do it.
Courting is...
Digital.
Music, memes. Mm-hmm. And if you're not, you know, versed in any of that, you're pretty much on the sidelines.
And it shows just in basic conversation. And, you know, to your point about 2020, after that happened and all these social justice groups started to create this movement. And I know that there's differences of opinion on what that movement was, but let's just say for the greater good, it was to prevent anything like George Floyd from happening again. What they didn't understand is that they made that a possibility tenfold by doing what they did.
Because of the standards now being lowered.
Yes, and you're going to have more Derek Chauvins on the street now. You just multiplied them by 1,000.
That's one of the aspects of law enforcement that I just got to experience. I got to experience before that and after that. Like, I would go to police academies before that, seeing some of the, like, you know, and then after just seeing people just not wanting to be that anymore.
Just subpar guys who probably would have been told, and guys and gals who probably would have been told, thanks, but we'll call you. And now it's like, when can you start?
Yeah.
And I see even my agent, it's everywhere. Everywhere you go, you just kind of look and you go, this is
that's exactly
the cream of the crop. Like,
and that's exactly what happened in Mexico for years. That's why, I mean, to this day, I'll say, hey, you're a cop in Mexico? Yeah. He was a criminal, basically, it's what people think about.
Yeah.
Cop in Mexico, criminal.
Corruption, yeah.
Right. So you're getting to that, you're getting through that process with American police officers where they're like, you're a cop? Yeah. Okay. Like,
it's almost like you don't want to share that anymore. Like before, and I don't really care, but like, I always tell my family, like, don't introduce me as that. But lately, it's kind of like, it's like, oh, you are? Oh, you're. He's a baby killer or like whatever.
Yeah,
like,
whatever. Yeah.
You just kind of rub that way. And
I'm familiar with that aspect. I didn't tell a lot of people what I did for a living for a while. It was like a shocking surprise to some of them.
And you get treated differently too as a result, socially. Oh, like they may
suspicion. They think the worst of you.
Yeah. You know? Or if you talk to them for a half hour and then it gets discovered, they go, wait, what? Like, you're a cop?
Yeah,
you're
a cop. Yeah. But like for me, the, I don't know, I know being a cop means different things in different places. I was a cop in Tijuana. Out of all the fucking legendary cities to be a cop, I was a cop in Tijuana, and Baja specifically, in the state of Baja.
Couldn't even imagine.
It's fun. It's a fun place. But the stigma around the job itself and the title, it follows me to this day.
Yeah.
You know, online people go after me because of corruption and association. You know, like I was everything bad that anybody did in the office that I worked at, that's all on me too.
Yeah.
Which is, that's what I'm seeing with the phenomenon in the U.S. where cops are now being blamed in general if one of them does something horrible, you know?
Yeah, it's frustrating.
It's frustrating, and also I can imagine it leads to a lot of anger.
Yeah.
Which again produces
the results that we're looking at. And when you have short staff, overtime, we're all human. I think the human element doesn't get acknowledged enough. And I'm not saying that makes corruption or just bad stuff okay, but it does play a factor.
Oh, yeah.
And you're an employee. And if you're being mandatory to overtime, you're being just work to the bone and there's no staffing, there's no this. That's most California cities right now. Well, yeah, no wonder they're pissed off. And that will transfer over to the street and to the community.
So you're already kind of like versed in, that when I say versed, I mean you've already experienced a lot of tragedy in your life by the time you get there. experiencing loss at work. I know, at least for me, I had a lot of experiences in my life, both, you know, just growing up and having tragedy behind me, and growing up really quickly. Yeah. Like, I lived alone when I was like 14, 15. Like, I moved out. It's like, what the fuck? I was Peter Panning shit, you know? So when I got into the position that I got into, I was pretty mature for my age, and I'd done most of the things that these kids were trying to figure out for themselves. Like, mm-hmm. I remember coming out of the academy and they were trying to figure out apartments, and I already had one.
You know? Yeah.
Like, this is how you do it. So, and when it came time to loss, you know, this whole aspect of you go to an academy, you go to training, you go to a lot of things, you shoot a bunch of paper, you shoot a lot of rounds, they train you how to put a tourniquet on somebody, you learn all these skills and all these things, but nobody sits down with you and talks to you about, like, hey, if somebody's going to die, this is what you have to do.
Yeah.
There's no, hey, this is what happens when you're going to accompany somebody in their last moments of life. Yeah. Or this is what happens when you have to death notification, shit like that. Mm-hmm. Like, what was that experience like for you?
I was pretty well adapted, and I'll just call it life experience, which I think plays a huge, and me being the age I am now, looking back on the last, you know, 15-ish years, life experience does so much for anyone who works in public service, not just law enforcement, but it really shows you, if you already have an idea of just how fucked up the world is, it's going to make it much easier for you to swallow all of that one day. And I always remind people that there will be a day that's going to sort of make you really go, oh shit, this place is evil. This world is a horrible place. And it really is. It's a great place, but it's also fucking terrible. And until you see that part, you're not going to understand it till you smell it, see it, taste it.
Somebody told me this once, and it fucking changed my life. Every single tragedy you're trying to avoid will happen.
That's great.
Like, every it's single true. One
yeah.
will happen. And you can't avoid it, but you can be strong for them. You get to a moment where that happens at work.
Yeah. My first death notification, I remember it very vividly. I was on training, and it was just one of those ones where, and it depends on who's teaching you, because you'll go through all these different, you know, leaders, senseis, masters, whatever, and you're going to take away bits and pieces. And for most of them, you might even take away things that you saw that's not a good way to
do. Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah. And I remember he was like, all right, we just got to go get it done. It's like a Band-Aid. Just tell them they're dead. And I was like, okay. And he's like, that prevents confusion. Because if you say they've passed on, they're not here anymore,
you have to, like, you know, prolong the conversation.
Are they dead? Or, like, and you know, in that moment, that person is going to remember 5% of what you said. And we went and told this lady that her son was dead, and she flipped out. Yeah. But I remember just, we left really quickly, and it was just, I didn't feel like it was good. And that was his thing, though. He didn't want to do that. And then I had, you know, a different FTO, different people. And I started to develop my own style. And my mindset was, what would I want for my family if someone came to tell my mom that I was dead? How would they want that conversation to go? And there's no good way to do it. There's just different ways to do it. And hopefully some are catered to the scenario or circumstance. Yeah. Because if I... on graves especially, I hated waking people up. It was like, there's no good reason for the cops to come to the door
at night. And yeah.
For vehicular fatalities, I worked really closely with CHP, especially this one guy who's really good, Chippy out there. And if there was a vehicular fatality, he would come with us and we would do the whole spiel, and he would explain the traffic end of it. So the explanation would mean more. It would have more... No one likes to wonder. They always wonder what, because
and again, just from my experiences, there's immediate disbelief and denial
for sure
that just sets in.
Yeah.
And they're trying to find holes in your explanation of what happened. Like, are you sure this is the right person?
Are you sure you have the right name? It's like, I just saw their head on the side of the road.
Are you sure? Or like, And then depending on the person, that sometimes it turns into anger and blame. So they start like, so like, who's at fault? Like, who do I have to like, I don't know.
It's in a detective capacity. It's kind of weird, but I'm a detective now. And in our agency, we do homicide rule out for every single firearm suicide that occurs in the county. I've worked homicides that were simpler than some of the suicides that we've worked because family, most of the time, I can tell you how your loved one went to the ATM, got money, was shot 3 times in the sternum, and they died. We have this guy in custody. He's the one who did it. He actually confessed. They go, okay, well, that explains that. Telling someone that, you know, your brother killed himself, they put a shotgun in their mouth and blew their head off. You can explain everything, but when they say why, well, there was no note. I don't know why. Those will require, oddly enough, even though it's not even a crime, it's going to create a large amount of follow-up. And just it's so trippy how that works. But those will be some of the most complex things you'll deal with sometimes.
It's the quiet, sudden suicides. Mm-hmm. Like, at work, we would find people that just, you know, one day, it's too much. The whole note aspect of it, like, that's a whole, people assume that people are just going to sit down and write a note sometimes.
It's a very common assumption. I would say less than 50%.
Yeah, I mean, people that get into that mindset that I'm going to take my life now, sometimes it's like a...
Right now.
A flurry. Like, something happens, an event of some sort, and they just... I had a guy at work that... A few that went that route, and it was not always. I mean, there were signs, you know, and we would do the best that we could to kind of like manage it. But sometimes it was just like one of them had discovered his girlfriend with somebody else, and that night it just happened. And the same thing. His family was trying to figure out if somebody snuck in there.
It's a murder.
Somebody somehow snuck into this locked house. Yeah. And
or he didn't write that note. Someone else did.
It went on for years.
Yeah.
That he was murdered. And they just couldn't fathom that he just took his own life.
And that comes from guilt. So a lot of family, just in my personal experiences and also work stuff, if you think that it was a possibility and it finally happens, you'll never forgive yourself ever. Yeah. Thinking that you could have done something. So that's where they commonly will introduce, well, is that really what happened? Or are there other things? It's sad, but you're like, no, this, I don't have any evidence to show otherwise.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry he's gone or she's gone, but.
When you say that you were trying to kind of come up with your own style after seeing other people doing it horribly, because I've been behind people doing death notifications and just being like, ugh.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing, dude? Just be a good human being.
I had a system. I would. And the C word, the real one, is control. And if you can control most of the environments you're in, whether it's emotional, physical, whatever, you're going to be more successful. So not control in a literal sense, but I wanted to be able to control the information that would come out, whatever I could do to facilitate assistance. And then it just sort of depended on the circumstance. So if you had someone that, you know, car accidents were common, and as our agency, we operate as a coroner as well. So we have coroner detectives, but for the most part, you're going to be the guy doing their, you know, moving the body and doing the notification and all that stuff most of the time. But it would be case by case. And sometimes the cases were just so, even the simple ones could be really complex, but I would really try to have as much information as I could, have the time, more importantly. And that's the big part. You have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. And if you do it enough, you'll get good at it. But I'd be lying if I said before I knocked on the door, I wasn't just like, motherfucker, let's do this. Yeah. And then you would kind of judge their reaction and then kind of set a tempo. Are there kids home? Are there, you know, what else do we have to start dealing with? And then just help. But you also eventually have to leave. And the departure is hard because that person is going to have questions 30 seconds after you walk out the door. So it's a really tough to put it into like a, if I had to have a recipe, it would be based on the kitchen I was in and I have to go find all these different things to use. And I mean, the bottom line is it sucks. Don't make it suck more than it has to for them.
I wanted to take this opportunity to thank each and every one of our Patreon members for their generous support. It's the only way we can bring some of these amazing people behind the microphone and have some of these amazing Midnight of the Soul conversations for you guys. If you're not already a part of the Patreon community, please consider joining us. We have our giant online training catalog for you guys to have access to, as well as some exclusive Sneak Reaper Industries merch drops for you guys at the Dead Drop tier. I would also like to thank the company Sneak Reaper Industries, one of our main supporters and a company that provides some of the most amazing urban wear, survival specific, and cutlery out there. Your support not only makes this show possible, but also supports some of the charities that we run, including the Fighter's Kitchen out of Puerto Escondido, where we're supporting some up-and-coming fighters under the tutelage of Eddie Farrell. Thank you for your support, and again, please consider joining us on the Patreon. And now back to the show.
And also, the you mentioned this whole aspect of mentorship and having people that learn from mm-hmm. other people. I had some pretty cold military people around me for training and also just as mentors. And these guys were amazing at what they did, but they were savages. When I say savages, I mean they were cold and mechanical in kind of the way they would approach things.
Which is good.
Which is good for the environment, except sure. when it came to dealing with people.
Yeah.
And I think a big aspect of what gets done wrong in Mexico is that we've lost a lot of our humanity in a lot of ways. One, because the normalization of the level of violence that we have to go through on a daily basis yeah. here is pretty wild. So we'll see people jump over a body to continue eating their tacos
yeah.
without just fucking...
Well, Tijuana has a homicide, one of the highest in the
right
world?
Now, yeah. It's right now, yeah. it's when I was active here, it was the most dangerous city on the planet. And according to MetLife, we had the most dangerous job on the planet at that time.
Yeah.
I remember a death notification I did over the phone. And this is one of the like regrets that I have. I have a lot. I did a lot of horrible shit. But I remember being angry, frustrated, and hungover. I wasn't married and I didn't have any family. So I was expendable in a lot of ways. So they would send me off to the shittiest assignments. And one of them was you would get either New Year's or Christmas off. You would have to pick, right? If you were lucky, but if you didn't have any family, you would work both. And I was one of the condemned, you know? So I stayed on and worked, I think it was New Year's. We drove up to a scene. They just shooting. They shot a lot of kids outside of a party. When we got there, they were still warm. You could still smell the gun smoke.
Mm-hmm.
The blood was still kind of streaming. Gravity was still kind of pulling some of that blood into the street.
You could smell it.
It was fresh. You know, some of the music was still on, and it was like. A lady came over and handed me a cell phone. And I was just trying to see if anybody that was there still tried to kill us. Taking off a gun off one of the dead bodies. Collecting phones for site exploitation stuff. And this lady just walks over to me. Old lady. Big ass phone. This is the mother of... Can you tell her what happened? And I'm kind of in work mode and irritated by this. Like it's an interruption. So I have one hand on my rifle and I grab the phone and I listen and I'm saying, like, who is this? Who is this person? Oh, this is Maria and that's Daniel. Like, hey, is this Daniel's mother? Yes. Your son was shot and killed. And I just heard this. I had to separate the phone from my ear. And then I put it back close and I just start hearing all these questions and I blank out. My memory blanks out there. I just know it was like I had all these bodies around me and this fresh scene and I was trying to keep people away and other people started showing up. I was getting asked for information over the phone and stuff like over the radio. And my mind was just consumed in this phone and this voice that was coming out of there. It was just grief. Handed the phone back. I continued on doing what we were doing. The kids were picking up the shell casings outside. But they wouldn't pick up the ones that were covered in blood.
Just the clean
ones. Just the clean ones. Like I'm just seeing this horrible fucking scene in front of me. And the lady, like I'm looking for this lady after like in my mind, I'm like still thinking about this mother somewhere.
Yeah.
Like I could just envision her running towards the scene somehow. But before we leave, like the municipal police showed up and other people showed up and I was making my way out. I was looking through the crowd to see if I could see that same lady to ask her like, hey, what's going to happen, right? She kind of went like I found her and was like, hey, like where's the mother? Oh, she's in Puebla. She's like on the, it's like a 3-4 hour plane ride.
Shit.
And this is a family that's not going to be arriving on plane. A bus is probably the best they can wish for, and that's going to take them a few weeks probably. And I just get I make a mistake and I get invested. I give him a guard, and I get calls later, which I had to deal with, you know, how to questions and shit like that. And I had to change my phone after a while because it just I didn't have any answers, and that's one of the regrets I had. Basically, ghosting this grieving mother that all she wanted was like answers, and I just didn't have any. And I just opened myself up to lying to her that I could.
It's interesting that you view that as a regret, because most people wouldn't give a shit. Or the stoic, kind of not stoic, but the cold.
I think a lot of people would give a shit. I think a lot of people wouldn't express it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Talking about it's the hard part.
I never talked about that ever with anybody from work. Because I would, in Mexico, we have this phobia of mental health.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, if you had to use force in any way, shape, or form at work, you would get sent to a psychologist. And depending on what the psychologist said about her analysis or his analysis of you, you would get, you could get your carry license suspended. Mm-hmm. So, like, nobody wanted to deal
with it. I'm great. Good. How are you?
Yeah. So you would be coached
before
you would go into that interview of how to fake not giving a shit about what you did, I guess, or that you're okay. I constantly tell people when it comes to some of the training that I provide for people or some of the classes that we host, like, hey, I wish I knew all of this shit before I started. But main thing, I wish people would have taught me how to deal with death.
Yeah.
You know, just what do you do?
We do everything else, but
yeah,
like, that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, it's becoming popular, but not, it's, I don't want to ever say it's too late, but it is too late for some people.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that the focus has changed and longevity and the days of, the guys who used to just eat it, they're dying of strokes and heart attacks right now because they just ate all that shit and they didn't. You don't have to talk about your feelings, but you do have to do something about it in order to live a long life. And you couple that with the old school mentality of just drink it away or fuck it away or do whatever you're going to do. And then you just create more destruction.
I don't think it was never taught to me to be like the, for me, it was like avoidance. You know, like how can I shut my head off after what I just went through?
Good luck. It's
yeah, like how can I, And the answer that most of us got quickly was blackout drunk, which is basically starving your brain of oxygen for a bit, I guess. And that's like when you get blacked out, that's alcohol poisoning.
Yeah. Drinking's a great coping mechanism. It's not healthy, but it works.
It's not healthy at all, but if you pair that with your 20s, that shit is a superpower for like, how can we get this 20-year-old dude to do some of this horrible shit and like do it constantly and for a long period of time? And we would get people like they would organize these fucking these parties that were just all about just getting us all wasted.
Yeah.
Just to kind of like chill us out and then send us back out. And I know that happens in militaries across the world where they're like, hey, guys went through some shit. Let's all get shit faced and celebrate. No, let's all anesthetize you guys.
Yeah.
That's exactly what let's put some anesthesia to you guys. Let's avoid talking about all the bad shit. Put some music on and have some people come here and entertain you for a bit. And then you're back out there. And you're right. That shit festers inside of you.
Oh, yeah.
It's like it's not cancer, but it probably related to cancer as far as what it produces inside people. I believe that
it absolutely could. It can do anything. And I've seen guys just live life and live that mindset and lifestyle. And some of them survive. Some of them go on to live another 80s and have a good life. And the majority of them don't, though.
Yeah.
They'll end up having some type of really bad health issue later on. And
that's why every time I see somebody made it to their 90s and I'm like, you probably had a good dude. Every now and then. There's some fucking Marines that I've met who went through Iwo Jima shit like that. Like in their 90s and 80s.
Still kicking.
I don't know. It's a generational thing. Maybe they were taught how to deal with some aspects of loss or trauma.
Mental, and also I think like there's got to be something going on with health too. But yeah, it's wild to see just the, I don't know how to put it into a sentence, but how self-destructive we can be in law enforcement to ourselves intentionally.
In any field where you're sending, where homicide is on the table as far as your job requirement.
Yeah.
For sure. So like, you know, police, of course. And like, I have a bunch of friends who were in the military and were kind of like showing up, and you see some of the lines of service related deaths versus suicides and how that just lunched.
It's insane how that
like the whole aspect of winning the battle but not winning the war. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, we didn't lose these guys in Afghanistan, but
lost them here.
Yeah, we're losing them like every day. I just had a new friend of mine, the dude I was talking to. I don't want to say his name, but he was an amazing dude, high level guy. Shit ton of like just a laundry list of plans. Like, Ed, help me out with this. Hey, like human trafficking.
I think I know who you're talking about. You live in San Diego.
Yeah, human traffic. Yeah. Like, help me out with this human trafficking thing. Yeah. And like, we're fucking talking about all these things, and all of a sudden,
out of nowhere, he was a beast.
He was a monument of a human.
Yeah.
Like, and you look at that type of stuff, and you're like, and I know what lives in people's, you know. There's definitely something to be said about a lack of preparation culturally. Like, a lot of us don't get the whole aspect of dealing with not only death, but also death, the responsibility that death provides those who have to partake in visiting that upon somebody.
Yeah.
But also the aspects of reinsertion or coming back from that. I mean, there's violence it's like a chemical burn.
Yeah.
I mean, you won't be the same after.
No.
It transforms you. And, you know, some people carry that inside and it grows. It just starts spreading. The aspects of Zen that you kind of infuse in your kind of like your work, where does that come from?
Well, I would really have to kind of give the basis of that to my mom. Even though I wasn't really into it when I was younger, that was a huge part of my childhood. A lot of holistic medicine and a very different perspective on.
And for people that don't understand what Zen is, can you like give us like a small, like your moniker online is Zen God, which is like, okay. But for people that don't know what Zen is.
Well, for the traditional sense, that's not really what I was going for. I wanted to bring, and that word means a lot to me in terms of my childhood.
Yeah.
My mom and all that stuff. But for what it means for my mission and what I'm doing now is that there was such an emphasis. And I really like how as a community, we have all these really great resources and we have all this training. And you could go on YouTube or Instagram and you could write a range day curriculum or a use of force curriculum in an hour, just sort of pick, okay, I got this.
Yeah,
I got this. I got this. When I really started to go through my own shit, I didn't see a lot of help or realistic help or help that was going to be conducive to success. And
going for a 5-hour marathon run is not going to help you out with your shit.
I mean, it'll help you feel good maybe, but it's not going to really change much. And I really sort of started to explore, you know, the kind of the concept of self-care in terms of meditation, in terms of just allowing yourself to be open to other ideas. And for me, Zen just means, it means peace and finding, which is funny because if you ask most people, hey, what's the deal with, you know, they would anything but Zen is probably what I would be compared to in my work and social life. But I had to find a baseline medium. And for me, it was finding, trying to get creative, I guess, and to find things that were easy to do. And again, it's case by case, but allowing myself to be open to new ideas and falling back on a lot of the things that I was taught when I was younger that I ultimately kind of dismissed. And I was like, that's not going to work. It's stupid. This is a waste of time or whatever. And all the things that my mom introduced to my childhood and even other people along the way.
Meditation, breathing. Yeah.
Breath work is huge. You know, therapy, EMDR, brain spine. There's all kinds of things that it takes a lot of buy-in. And so, you know, with what I'm doing now, initially it started out as a blog. That was just but that was more for me. Writing was a really big outlet for me.
Yeah.
And it was huge. I could put.
Same thing happened to me. It was like, I have a lot of shit that I want to share. How can I do it? And it started off by this anonymous, faceless Tumblr account called That's Manifesto. That's where I started. And it was an outlet. Like I just went through this shit. Like, where can I put it?
Yeah, it's good, but it gets your thoughts on something. And I still write a lot. I don't publish 50% of it just because it's for me. But I learned really quickly that that was going to help me navigate this new sort of chapter in my life that I didn't think was going to happen to me because it came on so suddenly. And that was 4 years ago. And prior to that, I don't want to say that I was, you know.
What change that brought on this for you 4 years ago?
So. Around my 10th year in law enforcement, I've been in detectives for a year and I couldn't tell you why. I have no idea. A combination of everything over the years is my assumption. And that combination includes all kinds of fun stuff, just weird fucked up shit. On July 11th of 2020, I was sitting on my couch. And it was a normal morning. It was a Saturday. I suddenly felt my heart racing through my chest. I had this feeling of like, oh, fuck. I stood up and I go in the kitchen and I'm like, something's wrong with me. I don't really know what's happening right now. And I told my wife, I said, we need to go to the hospital. And she says, okay.
What are you feeling?
My heartbeat and just this anxiety, like looking back now, what I know. Yeah. But I mean,
it's like a weight. A feeling of weight, existential dread.
Insane. Dread. Impending doom. Just
doom. You think it's a heart attack and you feel center of your chest pain, weight.
I literally told her, I said, I think I'm having a heart attack.
Yeah.
And so she says, what? And I'm like, let's get in the fucking car.
Yeah.
And so we get in the car. Longest drive of my life. And I it's funny. I've done all this neat shit over the years and I've been scared before and we've you know, I'm sure you can relate, just calls and where you just go, yeah, we probably could have died. Oh my God. It's just the typical adrenaline bullshit. But I was the most terrified. I can't even find a word to describe how terrified I was, knowing that I had no control over this scenario.
Yeah.
And so we drive to the urgent care, which thankfully wasn't very far away. And I walk up to the counter and they're like, hi, what can we do for you? And I was like, yeah, I'm kind of having chest pains. I think I'm having a heart attack. And I go to sit down and they're like, no, stop, come here. You're coming back right now. Like, oh, cool. And I'm kind of in my mind, like downplaying it, like calm, like relax. I'm like, I can't get control of this feeling. And they hook me up to the EKG machine. It comes back abnormal. And they're like, cool, go to the big hospital and your wife can drive you, or if you want to go in an ambulance, whatever, but just get down there. So I go down there, same thing. I bypass the line and go do all this blood work, x-ray, like the whole nine, is hours and hours in downtown Sacramento in the middle of the night, which is amazing. And I'm sitting there and the doctor comes out and he's like, hey, how's it going? We're going to clear you good. You're not having a heart attack. And I said, that's great. What happened? And he goes, I don't know. Follow up with your primary care and we'll figure it out. Okay. And what was really horrible is that the following day we were leaving for vacation. We go to Joshua Tree every year.
Yeah.
And so the following morning we were leaving to go to that. And I'm just like, oh my God. Like, and again, going back to the driving thing, I was like, do you mind driving? And she's like, what? I can do it. And I was like, yeah, just, I don't know if I can. I don't know how to just, anxiety and anxious is the wrong word. I felt like my chest was cracked in half. I just couldn't.
I don't know. I've heard it called panic attack, anxiety attack. I don't know. For me, when I've experienced that before.
It's terrible.
Yeah. Don't go on WebMD if you're getting any of that, because that's the worst thing.
It'll just make you more anxious. Oh God.
For me, it was like a sudden thing that happened like on a Sunday morning. The whole aspect of just being like, huh,
yeah, just
there's nothing
out.
Happening. And all of a sudden you're like, shit.
It was terrible. We go to Joshua Tree and we get there and it's in Yucca Valley. Technically it was an Airbnb, but it's in the middle of fucking nowhere. And so as we're driving to the location, it's very dirt, very rural. And I'm just thinking about the ambulance and how that's going to be able to get to the house. And then we get to the house. And I go out, beautiful view. And I just go, fuck, we're so far away from where the hospital is. And then there's a whiteboard on the fridge and I write down the address. And my wife's like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm writing down the address. So if I get up in the middle of the night, I know exactly where we are. And she's like, oh, that's smart. I'm like, great. Didn't sleep that night. Didn't really have a great vacation, but made it work. Come home the following weekend. Same thing happens. I go back to the doctor. Same thing. And do the whole nine.
You're doing all this mental math. Like it's a heart.
It's got to be condition. Yeah, this is something. And the doctor comes out. It's a different doctor this time. And he's like, hey, no heart attack. Like, what do you do for work? Are you stressed? I said, I'm a cop. And he's like, well, that might be a problem. And he's like, have you ever had a panic attack? I said, I don't know what that is. Like, I've heard of it, but I don't panic. And he's like, well.
And it doesn't matter. You deny it.
Oh, very
because
much so.
You're like, what do you mean fucking panic attack? Yeah. Look at all the shit that I've done. Like, I jumped out of fucking a plane once. I fucking did all this shit. Why would I be panicking on a Sunday after going to a pizza party with my kid?
Unknown.
Like, it's because it's all being fucking stored.
Yeah. And it will finally come out. And he told me, like, hey, well, I remember asking, so what do I do? Like, he had like a pill I could take and everything would be fine. And he's like, well, that's up for you to decide. It might be a long road. And I was like, well, that's great. I don't really have time for a long road. Like, is there anything I can do now? He's like, you need to relax, first of all. Like, you're stop thinking about it. And I was like, I can't stop fucking thinking about it. Like, I can't. But I go see my primary care, and obviously there's concerns. So we're going to do some tests, and they're going to do all this. And I have the Holter monitor. No results. Your heart's healthy. Great. Heart CT. Heart's healthy. Great. Everything's fine. I keep getting told I'm fine going through all of these, like, test, and I'm getting upset that there's no answer.
Yeah.
And they finally do a mammogram for the chest pain to rule out breast cancer. And I go in the thing and they smash my, and I'm like, oh God. And then the nurse jams out of there real quick. And I was like, oh shit, I'll be right back. And it was after the test had ended. So I thought, oh my God, I have breast cancer. This is going to be sad for a day. And my coworker is going to be laughing at me. I'm going to have pink shit everywhere. Cops are relentless. Like it's going to be serious for 20 minutes. And then the rest of it, pray for Max tits or whatever. And So she comes back in with the doctor, and the doctor's like, yeah, your scans are clear. Sorry, we had a woman fall over in the lobby. I was like, oh, thank God. And we leave the room, and there was an ultrasound tech who was waiting for me. And the doctor said, nope, no ultrasound. And she's like, yay, no ultrasound. And I'm like, who cares? No ultrasound. And I walk out in the lobby, and as I'm leaving, I see all these women who look like they're going through chemo and scarves on their head, and just they look like they have cancer. And I just went, oh, that's why no ultrasound. I didn't have to go farther. So maybe I should stop being a piece of shit and be thankful that I don't have something wrong with me and start appreciating the fact that, you know, I'm healthy and I have a lot of work to do. And my doctor told me, he's like, do you go to therapy? I said, no. He goes, start. He goes, start changing some things. And like, you just gotta, you gotta work at it. He's like, I know you already have a lot to do, but you got more now. And at the time, I mean, work was nuts. We had a bunch of just pretty intense cases. And then, yeah, I just didn't stop. So I really had to make some changes, and I did. But if you would have told me that this is going to be an issue for we're, and even right now, I'm better, but I'm not 100%. I don't think I ever will be, because this is just who I am now. But if you would have told me it'd be years before you actually see any real changes, yeah, I probably would have blown my head off. And the closer that I got to what I would refer to as like the, you know, I guess maybe my internal version of the upside down or the opposite or places that you'd never been as a human, around the third month, when I was really still trying to like figure out what the hell was wrong with me, probably the worst I've ever been mentally, and not understanding what that felt like. We had a emergency vehicle operations training, and I was driving there, and the whole few weeks I was already just like, I didn't understand. I don't know how to put it into a sentence other than I just felt really gross. My brain felt like there was just a bunch of black shit up in there, and I couldn't get it out of my head. And I was driving, and I just got this weird feeling. I was wearing my gun, and I got this weird feeling about the gun being in the car. And I was at this intersection, and I thought I could just pull over and put it in the trunk. Like, what is going on? Are these suicidal ideations? Is that what that feels like? And I didn't want to touch the gun because I was scared. So I just left it, started driving, got to do EVOC. Maybe it was the adrenaline dump. I don't know. But when we were done, I kind of was just like, something's wrong. This isn't normal.
Yeah.
And how do I talk about this? How do I, and I didn't know what to do, but that was a toe in the water to that side of mental health, to think about the people who had to dive in. I had a new understanding and respect, and more so an understanding of how those people ultimately chose to leave
early. Yeah. I mean, one of the main issues that a lot of people like myself have is that when we discover or are orientated toward trying to figure out ourselves, you know, and we seek out medical attention.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
You have, on one end, like I remember trying to find that for myself when I was still with somebody. Having your significant other, one, obviously, with my ex-wife, it was, I wasn't allowed to share stuff from work.
Her role or your role?
Both.
Both.
And it was painful on my end because there was nothing but lies then, you know? There's no covering up a wound except with lies, yeah. You know? So, and also the ignorance that you, it's not ignorance, but just an experience that you encounter with like, hey, whatever happened to you, Ed, just go talk to somebody and you'll be fine. Just like a psychologist. My friend went to one. It's like, cool. What did your friend go through? You know?
Yeah.
That he just went through a psychologist for a while and it just helped him. For me, I remember just having this giant, I can't relate to anybody. So why share it? Yeah. And also I wasn't allowed to because it would upset people. So let me just swallow it. I would get these just moments of frustration and I would just explode. It wouldn't be, I mean, I've never been violent with my, you know, dysregulations, which is a word that I learned later on. Are you dysregulated? It's like, oh, that's a word? Fuck, it's a cool word. For me, it was always isolation and evasion. I would just fucking ghost the world for a few days and worry people. But I just couldn't find any comprehension, which is what I was looking for, you know, going through some, like I've been through and still I'm going through the therapy, you know? And I remember having this question, like, what do you wish the most, Ed? I said, I wish I had a TV on top of my head with like a play-by-play video of everything that happened to me so I can click on it and like people like, hey, what's wrong with you? And I could just play this video. Right? So people could understand.
Yeah.
But there's just, there's different things that people can go into. Like therapy was great for me. Like one-on-one is good. Group therapy is way better.
Yeah, a lot of guys don't like it, but once you see it's...
Yeah, for me, it's like, hey...
I'm not the only one.
I'm not the only one, and also there's some fucking worse shit that could have happened to me.
Oh, for sure.
And it pulls you out of your mental bubble of just thinking about your own shit.
Yeah.
Medication works for some people. For me, I'm fully aware that a lot of the aspects that make me creative and or somebody that people follow or find entertaining or some of the aspects that provide me with the creative energy to make and do the things that I do, because I'm very much a performance artist in a lot of ways. All instructors are performance artists in a lot of ways. It's directly attached to my trauma and my pain. It's like a symbiotic relationship. So when you start taking medication for one, you kill the other.
Yeah.
So it's like people that assume that it's as easy as just going to talk to somebody, or it's easy as just fucking taking some medication.
It's not.
Or it's easy as just going through like 2 years or 4 years of therapy. It's like, fuck no. Like some people have it way more some people have a way more complex issue.
Yeah.
For me, it's been about just I describe it almost as an archaeological dig. Yeah. You know, you start kind of sifting through and like, oh, I'm an alcoholic. That's my issue.
Mm-hmm. But there's a reason there underneath.
But you think you're fucking new to this shit. I'm an alcoholic. Let me just stop drinking.
Not that simple.
You fucking stop drinking, you know, you do it I did it the stupid way. And I always warn people, don't do it like me. I went and locked myself in a fucking ranch in the middle of nowhere. Don't do that shit. I almost died. Yeah. But I went through that and I was like, this is gonna be a dramatic change. I'm gonna come out transformed, and I would read all these books about people that stopped drinking. And like I would go to meetings and I would hear other people just this amazing stories of them like, yeah, I used to be a piece of shit and I drank a lot, but now I stopped drinking and I went to therapy and now this is my wife and this is my kid. And I'm like, I've done all that shit and I don't have the after story. Like, what about me? Like, when am I going to get the after story? And then you start realizing it's like, oh, wait, the alcohol is just a fucking the topping of the tree, the Christmas tree, you know, there's more layers to it. And as you go down, you're sort of like, oh, I was addicted to alcohol because I was masking this and this. And also I was escaping from this. Oh, it's my trauma from work. So I went through a horrible fucking trauma at work, like some fucking superhuman shit. You know, that's it. But no, Like, why did you go into that line of work? And it's like a dig. Mm-hmm. And if people don't, and I get why people leave, stop that work on themselves, because it's fucking deep.
Yeah.
And if you have a significant other, relationships, I've found from my experience, if you're planning on working on yourself in a way of that, in that level of a way, if you went through a lot of shit and you're trying to do that, whoever's with you is not going to stay, probably, because not a lot of relationships survive that type of level of work on yourself. And if they were there before you started the work, whoever they were with dies during that work. And sometimes that doesn't lend. So if, like, again, like going back to my perception at the end, if you think you're going to get a happy ending during this process, all you're going to get it to is an empty room where you're sober as shit and you're fully aware of all the fucking fucked up crap that happened before. And that's it. That's going to be the ending of, not the ending, but like the, like a destination that you get to. I don't know. For me, it's been 5 years of trying to process shit, like legit sitting down with it.
Yeah.
And it's like a layered process. I've eliminated a lot of things, but I'm still like encountering new ones as I go through this process. And it's lonely as shit.
It is.
It's lonely as shit.
Normal. A lot of people get hung up on that. And I did. How am I going to be normal again? Well, normal before wasn't. I wasn't normal.
It's a lie.
I was living an unhealthy lifestyle.
It's a lie. A normal or back to normal. Mm-hmm. It's like, what the fuck is even that, you know?
And the rest of your life may be just broken, but that's okay. The car still drives. It's just dented.
Yeah.
And you just have to get used to driving with that body damage.
Yeah.
You know, metaphorically, but I think if most people understood that that was going to be the end game, you might not have your big ta-da moment. You might just have a very simple life.
Yeah, you might have a, like, that's, I spent my birthday 2 days ago watering my houseplants. Most of the friends that would show up in the past are all drinkers. Mm-hmm. And they would show up on my birthday and we'd have a drunken party. And now they're all gone because I stopped drinking. So a lot of those friendships were based on that. So they're not there anymore. Also, sobriety provides you with a great selection method as far as friendships and stuff like that.
Yeah,
so absolutely. Like a lot of those people who were there just to fucking predate on you, or those are gone. And, you know, this aspect of healing in your 40s. Like, the 40s is like, fuck, man. It's a lot of things have changed and a lot of things are in the past. And again, this aspect of you'll go back to normal or you'll have this happy ending somewhere in the front because you saw this guy that came to one of those talks and said, like, hey, look at my amazing family. Mm-hmm. Look at, like, this is a picture of us in Hawaii and all this shit. Like, all that is cool, but, like, the amount of times that's not going to happen at all for people.
I used to get really hung up on those things. You'd see these really cool stories, and a lot of them did focus on, like, oh, I stopped drinking, I stopped doing this. And then it's like, that's great, but this doesn't really fit my puzzle. This is my own. And it's cool to see stories of inspiration, but my rule for mental health, and I say this a lot, is individual experiences may vary, and yours might not be.
Comparison is poisonous.
Yeah. It's neat to look, but don't expect it to be the same because the outcomes might be entirely different. And the sooner you understand that, the more successful you will be for yourself in the future.
I think definition is pretty, I mean, for me, I realize that healing for me has been to be really sober with my solitude and to not run from my grief. It's not a picture of my family in Hawaii.
Yeah. Whatever motivates you. But the way that we tie pain, the brain is a very fascinating piece of equipment for the human body. And it's, if you're lucky enough, even though that sounds really weird, if you're lucky enough to experience the really fucked up shit, you're going to understand just how important it is to manage it, to take care of it, and will naturally hold on to those memories. And if you had a child, they're 3 years old, and mom's in the kitchen making cookies, and the kid walks into the kitchen and mom takes a finger and puts it in the sugar jar and puts it on the kid's tongue, he tastes it, and that's his first experience tasting raw sugar. It's a positive memory. It's sweet, makes him smile. In that same minute or two, mom opens up the oven and he touches the oven door. It burns his hand. It's hot. Mom puts some water on it, some ice, and the day goes on. He eats some cookies. The next day when he goes into the kitchen, though, he's going to remember the oven a lot faster than the jar of sugar. He may not even see the jar of sugar because the brain has said that this is important. We have to remember this really horrible thing that happened to you. And when we do that, we have this really neat ability to protect ourselves in the future. And with the way that the brain works, inside of our brains is this like a library. We have this this library inside of our head, and there's a little Ed up there. He's your librarian. He's going to be the one who decides, you know, what goes where and what's important and what's not. So if you want to do a little experiment, how about you tell me about the best day of your life. And I know we're kind of pressed for time. We're on a podcast.
It's fine.
But
I know exactly the day.
Well, tell me about the day and then make me feel like I'm there with you. Tell me about that day.
My kid's being born.
Yeah.
Me and my ex-wife had to have gone to some like Lamaze, and like they prepare you for what to expect, but we're fucking kids. We don't give a fuck about anything. So we don't go to any of these, and we just cold turkey. We just get to the hospital and wing it. There's a guy there in the waiting room with me who did go through it, and he's like, you know, trying to scare me, like, oh, you should have. Man, this process is going to be really difficult if you've never been through it before. You're probably like, I hope you're good with blood because you might faint, all this shit. And I'm looking at this guy. I'm terrified internally, though. Like, this is like, I've done a lot of stuff in my life by this point, but I'm about to welcome life into this world. It's fast. It's like I was expecting this whole drawn out process, and all of a sudden I have this girl, you know, this little girl, big eyes, black, like when people turn psychic in movies, it's just big black eyes, quiet. She cries for a bit, and as soon as they hand it to me, she just like looks at me, and she's quiet. I grab her, and I just know enough about this to put her on top of her mom. And it's just this moment, you know. Her mom went through some complications, and she almost bled out to death. So I went from the perfect moment to this crisis mode, you know. But I can't do anything about that because that's not on me. I have to stay with my kid, I guess. So that's happening, and I'm getting information on that end. So I'm stressed out as fuck on one end. But on the other end, I'm looking at my kid, and it's like, but look at this, you know? Mm-hmm. I see the other dude who was with me at the beginning of this experience with his kid crying. He's just crying his fucking lungs out. This guy looks like he does it. Deer in the headlights. He's like looking around for a nurse to like help him out. And like, he's just fucking losing his shit. So there was a bit of satisfaction in that, I guess. I have this moment with my kid there where they, you know, they give me some information about my about her mom. She's stable, but it was close. So that's kind of taken care of, and I have my kid now. And I get asked by the nurse that do I need to explain how to change a diaper. And my mom was fucking great. She showed me all the things that I knew. that you should know. So I said, no, I did my thing. I fell asleep on the floor next to her crib at the hospital. And before I fell asleep, I looked at her, and even though a lot of shit was on fire in my life, you know, I just realized that whatever else happens, at least I got to this moment.
That's awesome. It's a good day.
It was the best day I ever had.
Most people will, usually that's the most common thing, is childbirth is a game changer. It's a phenomenal memory. So we're going to flip it and tell me about the worst day of your life and make me feel like I was there with you.
Shit. There's a young guy working with us, motivated. I see a lot of myself in him. I'm old. I'm one of the old guys now. There, I'm in a command position. I'm an asshole in a lot of ways. We have to be, you know. We have to have the separation, you know. He wants to come with us to something pretty heavy. When I was at my most active, I was working directly with the command of the unit that I was in. So I was basically the director, the sub-director, and me. And we would, you know, grab or pick and choose some of the best guys to come with us to some of the heavier stuff because we knew we were going into shit. And sometimes some of that decision-making as far as who would come with us or not would be on me. And I would have this math that I would do in my head, you know, experience. But I also knew that some of them had family or inexperience. This kid would just, he would just pester me about going. And I broke down. I said, yeah, jump in. We went into a night of work, like from 3 a.m. to midday the next day. It was bad. It was a lot of death. A lot of, we would work with the military, and it was just bad. He was freezing a lot during the job. So I would grab him and kind of like just pull him around a little bit. You know, it's like, stack up and don't stand there. Just move. And I was really hard on him. Like I thought that's what he needed, just to be pushed. And it was a bloody night. It was a bad night. And he got to experience some of that directly. For the first time, it was the next day we were sorting everything out and we're doing a roll call and I couldn't find him. I found him, he was sitting, in this little patio area, staring at the sunrise, no shoes, no socks. Just his pants and no t-shirt on because he was covered in blood. So he just couldn't fucking bear it. Instead of going up to him and saying like, hey, are you okay? I showed up with anger. Like, where the fuck were you? Like, we've been looking for you. He didn't look at me at all. He just picked up his stuff, and I told him like, hey, just get in one of the cars. They're gonna go back now and just go. Before he left, I said, I told you didn't belong here. He shot himself 2 days later at the hotel where we're staying. Fuck. I think that was the That was a pretty bad day.
Horrible.
Yeah.
What's crazy is when we look at those two memories we have, right? The library and little Ed in your head when you talk about a good memory. You know, he looks around and you had a thought that came really quick, but it was probably one of those ones that just, it's very generic, but it's like when we choose kids is a good thing. But he goes and grabs this, you know, book about that thick.
Yeah.
Comes back and there you go. When we talk about the core memories that involve some of the horrible things that we see, he doesn't even have to go anywhere. He grabs it. No, I was reading it yesterday. Here's this book and it's about that thick. So that's the weird way that our brain will latch on to certain things. And when we look at the details you chose for the happy versus the sad or the despair, they're so different.
Yeah.
And the more we understand it, the easier it gets to process, but it's still going to be a memory that's going to literally ingrain itself on the inside of your skull. It's not going to ever leave. It can't leave.
No.
And in a weird way, that librarian doesn't even put it back because he knows you're going to think about it a lot more than childbirth. He's going to go catalog that back where it belongs and he'll get it when he needs it. But the despair, they're usually within arm's reach for that guy up there. So thank you for sharing that. That was as terrible. I mean, I can't even imagine. And
my experience was different than most people that I am friends with in the U.S. that I go to therapy with. Mm-hmm. Because there was no heroic aspect to any of the stuff we were doing, I guess. There was no idealism or code or brotherhood or it was mechanical.
Yeah. Very antiseptic.
Like militarized. Mm-hmm. And they would basically foster the worst in us. And one of the main things that they would try to do with us was basically detachment and also just being, you know, scary.
Yeah.
It's one of the main reasons I'm kind of funny online, I guess. Because I see other people online that have these personas. That went through experiences similar to mine and that have this, you know, I don't know.
Self-deprecating humor that kind of has to come out.
This iron mask that they make for themselves.
Yeah.
This, and again, I'm not going to name any names, but you know, people will know who I'm talking about. These, you know, multiple ultra marathons, breaking their feet running, superhuman, extreme ownership over whatever.
They're out there, yeah.
Look at me waking up at 3 a.m. and doing all this shit, or look at me doing these amazing trips across the globe doing this, or look at my amazing family and look at all the ways that I can make you have this amazing family as well. And I look at all of them and I'm like, I can't do any of that.
Yeah.
Because it's not true for me, at least. That's not genuine.
Yeah.
What you usually get with somebody with a lot of experience is somebody that's funny and somebody that warns you a lot about not going down that same path. And that's if there's something that I'm known for. It's writing down, and every now and then I get people to tell me if I could sign something, which is surreal to me. I don't know why anybody wants my signature. But instead of signing anything, I usually draw something.
Oh, that's cool.
Because I like drawing. Usually like a Mexican skeleton or a devil from the Loteria or something like that. And then just a signature and don't be me at the bottom.
I like that.
It's a warning. Just don't be me. It's like I'm a cautionary tale. Out of none of the shit that I went through, I consider heroic or that defined anything or made anything better. Like I don't have that with me as far as my life experience. I don't feel that way. I feel about some of the stuff that I'm doing with it now, like the after effects of it, like turning some of the poison into medicine aspect of
it. Yeah, which is great, but you still had to go through all that. The concept of the older guy telling you this thing you think you want, you don't.
Yeah.
But you're sitting there going, oh, fuck that, I want it. Yeah. Give me all that shit. And then here we are later going, well, we dodged it, but we're still not. I don't know what my life would be like without it, though.
No sales limpio. You're not going to get out of it clean, is what we would say.